Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So it's amazing for me to think that, as a layperson, I was just had a very small group of friends, didn't really hang out with that many people, and wasn't a big social person. But now here, I know almost everybody here. I've had some sort of relationship. So, becoming a monk, I wouldn't have thought that I would have a big circle of friends or Dhamma friends, Kalyanamitta. And so, Sangha, the Buddha talked about Savaka Sangha in the chanting. So, those who have practiced well, literally, Savaka Sangha is like stream enterers, once returners, non returners, arhants, but I like to think of it as just those who are practicing well. And the Buddha didn't say ordained Sangha, so we aren't just paying homage to the ordained Sangha, but we're paying homage to the Savaka Sangha, so those who have practiced well, whether lay or ordained. That's what we pay homage to when we're bowing to the Sangha as a one facet of the Triple Gem. And so we're here on a monastic retreat, and this allows you to explore the monastic edge. So what is that? That's not eating dinner. That's one aspect. And usually, just a simple shift in attitude will make it, if people find it difficult, a simple shift in attitude can make it a lot more enjoyable. And one is thinking of it not just in terms of renunciation, because the eight precepts are known as the renunciate precepts, but thinking of it as just giving your stomach a break. Just you normally just put so much in it, just giving it a break, just letting it relax a little bit for once, not always having to have something filling it. And that's kind of like practice, like in the mind, not always having to have something filling the mind. It's like sometimes we feel like we always have to have something filling the mind. We always have to be studying something or watching something or doing something or saying something. We always have to be doing something. So we come to a monastic retreat just to give ourselves a chance to learn why do people ordain? What is there to it? So we start to see what is this practice thing all about, Dhamma practice. What does it mean to be a Dhamma practitioner? Because there's so many angles, so many ways of looking at it. And certainly meditation practice is a big part of it, but it's not just about meditation practice. So it's about the way of life of people who are ordained is all centered around mindfulness. So that's what we're trying to do as people living in the monastery, trying to be mindful, keeping all these precepts and cultivating all sorts of renunciation and patient endurance is just to be able to be mindful. Because the Buddha said that mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Those who are not mindful are as if dead already. So we want to be truly alive. We want to be real people. Or like Lungpo Cha said, that every moment you're mindful, you're sane, and every moment you're not mindful, that's a moment of insanity. So we want to be fully sane people. And of course, the Arhant is the definition of a fully sane person, and everybody else is at least a little bit insane, whether monastics or lay people. So, because mostly what we're doing here is meditation, but also we're listening to teachings, and which is also another type of meditation. As the mind follows along with a teaching, then all sorts of wholesome mental factors are in place there. And whether it's listening to a teaching or reading a sutta, then all sorts of wholesome mental factors are coming into play. And so that's a good thing. That's what we want to be cultivating. I thought I would at least start by addressing the issue of the five hindrances. There was a question that came up about that, about wanting somebody to explain more about the five hindrances. And so I thought I would just start there and then see where it leads. But I think even before going into the five hindrances, that sometimes just the way we relate to the mind, if that shifts just a little bit, then the hindrances can go into abeyance quite a bit, can disappear for the most part. Because when we talk about the knowing or the way we use our awareness or attention, really there's a directing of attention on a meditation object such as the breath, but then also there's a director. There's the director directing that attention. So the attention is directed by something, and that's a really important thing to contemplate or think about, because what the attention goes to can show us who the director is at any given moment. And so if the attention is going to the five hindrances, then that shows us that the director is either greed or delusion. The director is Mara in that moment. So, and then when we are mindful and free of the hindrances, then of course the Buddho is the director, the one who knows. So there's always knowing, no matter who the director is, but that knowing is either tainted or untainted. So that's why practice, I think, is very gradual and takes a long time, because I think of it as like gradually shaking off the bad director and going with the good director. So gradually shaking off Mara and then going with the Buddha. And so we have to place the mind on something. The Buddha gave us mindfulness and things like loving kindness meditation, various contemplations, seven factors of enlightenment, Noble Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, Dependent Origination, and so on, things we can contemplate. And then that becomes, he's giving us that direction. It's really amazing that he discovered it himself without any outside direction. That's very amazing. So when the hindrances are coming up, and I feel I can talk about all of the hindrances because I've had a lot of experience with experiencing the hindrances, and probably more experience experiencing them than being able to get rid of them. But still, I think it just takes a long time. So it's good to know, good to have developed a set of tools for dealing with the hindrances. The first hindrance is sensual desire, which is, as human beings, we live in one of the three realms. We live in the desire realm. So beings in the human and animal realm are driven by desire and fear, mostly. And so we're born into that realm. So this is very much very primal, just part of our instinctual behavior, sensual desire. And we need it to live. We need it to procreate, but also just to eat, even. And we want to take care of ourselves, look after ourselves. We want comfort. We don't want discomfort. But when the hindrance of sensual desire comes up in meditation, then it's something which is not useful while meditating. And so, whatever it may be, it depends on the person, really. Like, there could be various contemplations that one could do around the sensual desire. So sometimes it's just a desire just for something other than just sitting here. So it might be some sort of mental proliferation, a desire for something pleasing to the eye, pleasing to the ear, something stimulating, a good taste, food. One may be hungry, so a desire for food may come up, or even a desire for greater comfort and physical well-being. And a lot of this is just a cultivation of patient endurance to deal with the sensual desire. But also it's a contemplation of the mind trying to get pulled into that which is pleasing. And so the mind is seeking, it's going out, it's trying to search around for something which will be pleasing. And that's just its habit. So really, it's going to do that no matter what, but a lot of the time it's just knowing what it's doing rather than buying into it and following along with it, just being able to see it and know that it's doing that, and know that however coarse the proliferation may be, that's just the nature of the mind. It's just habit, past karma coming up, and we don't have to feed it. So the important thing is to not feed it, not buy into it, not go along with it, but just to know it, to investigate and see the effect it has on the body. So is there tension? Sometimes for myself, there'll be tension in the eyes or the face if sensual desire comes up in the mind during meditation. The mind buys into it, bites onto it. The face crunches up just a little bit, so consciously calming the eyes, calming the face, it can be useful. Or a contemplation of just how unrealistic the actual proliferation may be. That's also helpful. Just like, is this something that has anything to do with reality? Probably not. And we can also think of it, if that's helpful for us, we can use the militaristic imagery. We can think of it as having to fight against it. For some people, that's helpful. And so we tell ourselves things like, just be steadfast, just work through this. Like, of course, the story of Lungpo Cha having a bout with sexual desire, and just afterwards, much later, he's asked, how did you get through that? And he said, the only way was just patient endurance, just really just not acting on it and just riding it out. So So especially as monks, we have our precepts, which are a protection for us, but also the eight precepts. So celibacy is included in the eight precepts. And that's a renunciate precept, which is helping the mind to maybe be able to concentrate easier or be more collected. It's like the simile of the wet, sappy piece of wood. So the mind enmeshed in sensual desire is like a wet, sappy piece of wood. And the Buddha said, like, you can't start a fire on that piece of wood. If you try to start a fire, it'll just go out really quickly. But then we use the precepts and the training, and then that wet, sappy piece of wood dries out over time. And then eventually we can start a fire on that piece of wood. So we're using the precepts. That's something that we're getting in touch with during a monastic retreat. The precepts are actually useful. We don't just keep them as some sort of way to punish ourselves so that our bad karma will disappear from the past or something. It's more they're useful training standards that we use to dry up that wet, sappy piece of wood. And we use that bright sun of the training, and it dries it out pretty quickly, and then we can start a fire. So then things can start to get interesting. The mind can start to get clear, clean and clear and pure, peaceful. So with ill will, irritation, that's the second hindrance. The Buddha defines kanti as like non-anger. That's one of the definitions of kanti, which we tend to translate as patient endurance. So ill will, irritation, this is like normal in terms of human interactions. So there will always be people we don't get along with, people that rub us the wrong way. Any community will be like this, whether a lay community, monastic community, there will always be difficulties in this way. When Longpa Sumedho was asked, usually sometimes like people new to practice will like to ask a Dhamma teacher, what's the fastest way to enlightenment? And somebody asked that, Longpa Sumedho. He said, well, just living in community is the fastest way to enlightenment. So because people rub us the wrong way, we get to watch our reactions, and hopefully nobody gets hurt. We have precepts against that too, but hopefully we keep them. And but it burns the mind. So we see how ill will, we see how that burns the mind. And so when it comes up in terms of meditation, in terms of being a hindrance, then it's painful. It's suffering here and now. It's painful here and now. It's to be relinquished here and now. So even though it's painful while it's happening, still somehow we can't get rid of it. Why is that? Even though the moment we get angry, we're unhappy, we're displeased. So why do we do it? Why do we still do it? We think somehow deep inside, somehow we think it's helping us. And it's not, it's a trick. So the Buddha recommended loving kindness meditation as an antidote to this, or goodwill, but really that's quite difficult to do while the ill will is arising. So it's good to cultivate it beforehand, so it's well established and can be accessed at any given time. And so the cultivation of loving kindness, it doesn't just mean saying may I be happy, may others be happy, but it's also a way that we express ourselves in terms of kindness or friendliness towards others. And that doesn't mean we have to like everybody. So we can actually be kind and nice to somebody, even if they're not like a friend or a close companion. We can still be nice to people. Really, that's how it has to be in community. Like in a monastic community, you can't just be friends or be really close with everybody. There will always be people who feel kinship with each other. There might be groups of monks who feel kinship with each other, but we can't just, it's not like we're all like super close friends, you know, all the time. That's and people come to the monastery to train as bhikkhus for the sake of liberation. So we feel kinship on that sense, but then there will always be differences of temperament, personality. So ill will arises. And really the defilements are always looking for an object, so it doesn't really have to be that much. Sometimes it could be just the way somebody looks at us, or we think somebody rolled their eyes at us or something, and then we can just bear resentment. We may even want to go to one of our friends and talk to them about it. I can't believe they rolled their eyes at me again. Did you see that? So we try to not do that. That's one of the benefits of noble silence. Like on this retreat, is just not being able to engage in expressing our sentiments in terms of bolstering up our own hindrances. I think the most important thing, though, with ill will is just seeing how it's suffering here and now. Just knowing it. And again, not getting caught in it. Same with all the hindrances. There is a way to know them and not get caught in them, except maybe sloth and torpor, where it's an absence of knowing. But the Buddha said, how is the Dhamma visible here and now? I think this is a sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. And the Buddha said that when one has a thought of anger, one knows there is a thought of anger. When that thought of anger disappears, one knows that thought of anger has disappeared. That's how the Dhamma is apparent and visible here and now. So the Buddha didn't say, how is the Dhamma visible here and now? One doesn't have any anger at all. So he didn't say that. He said, seeing the way things are and not denying that these things are arising. So sloth and torpor. This one is very interesting because there's all sorts of things we can do to keep ourselves from falling into sloth and torpor. On a meditation retreat like this, there's things we can be doing. One is usually, like, if I've been, because I've had a lot of experience with nodding, so I've tried to see what happens right before I start nodding in meditation, and usually, or almost maybe 99% of the time, it's like a daydream, a little daydream starts, and then once the mind locks into that daydream, then there'll be like a nod, And sometimes I'm able to catch it and get back to the breath. Sometimes then there'll be more nods if the mind gets too caught in it. And that kind of matches the Buddha's advice to Mahamoggallana. When Venerable Mahamoggallana was practicing for arhantship, then he was nodding, and the Buddha, by miraculous powers, appeared before him and said, "You know, Moggallana, are you nodding? Are you nodding?" And he said, "Yes, Lord, I'm nodding." And then he gave him some pieces of advice for not nodding. But the very first one is to, if you are drowsy and nodding, then to change the shift the attention, or shift the focus of the attention back to a suitable object. And I can't remember the orders, but then others include being attentive to light, washing your face, grabbing your earlobes and wiggling them, going outside, looking up at the stars or the sky. And at the very end, he says, "And if drowsiness doesn't disappear, then take a rest, you know, lie down for a little while." I know one winter retreat, when I was having a lot of problem with nodding, it was because I was trying to only sleep 4 hours a night, and so I ended that practice and started sleeping 5 and 6 hours, and then it disappeared pretty quickly. So we do have to know the right measure, and we might be able to go with less sleep if we're able to replenish ourselves more with our meditation, then we might be able to go with less sleep. So also food, drowsiness after meals, this is a big one. So sometimes we can rely on coffee, but also we have to look at what we're eating, the kind of things we're eating. I learned fairly recently that peanut butter causes a lot of drowsiness. And so, and that wasn't from experience, that's actually a scientific fact, that peanut butter causes drowsiness, or peanuts cause drowsiness. So you have to know which foods. It's like, it would be like drinking a cup of chamomile tea. And so if we want to battle drowsiness, then to cut back on the peanut butter maybe a little bit. And sometimes the mind will go through, the body and mind will go through like cycles where, depending on our mood and whatnot, we may be more drowsy or less drowsy. But if the mind is bright and peaceful, it'll tend to not be drowsy. I also, because I had a lot of problems with this, especially early on, I used to think that I was in a good state of meditation because all the meditations seemed to go by really quickly. And then I learned later that when I actually don't nod, then the meditation actually seems really long. So now when the meditation seems really long, I take that as a good sign. So, but it used to be like, wow, it seemed to go by really quick. It's like, wow, it went by really quickly. Yeah, so it's better. It's actually difficult. It's a difficult practice to meditate a lot and stay awake. It can be easier to fall asleep. If there was one monk who, he isn't a monk anymore now, but every meditation, within about a minute, his head would just go down and not come back up till the end of the meditation, and it would be quite extreme. Like the neck was quite bent a lot, and I asked him one time, "Doesn't your neck hurt from doing that?" And he said, Well, after a while, the muscles build up. So, wow. But he's not a monk anymore, so don't do that. That's not to be done. So sloth and torpor, not good. Don't do it. Restlessness and worry. This is a big one. One teacher once said, restlessness and worry is the defilement which a lot of good people get caught in, especially worry. And this can be, it's translated in various ways, like restlessness and remorse, or like worry and flurry. Is the Pali Vichikicca? Is that doubt or Udacha Kukucha? Yeah. Worry and restlessness and worry is Udacha Kukucha in Pali. And we can worry about all sorts of things. And if you feel bad that you're restless, then you can be consoled by the fact that the Buddha said restlessness only completely disappears at the time of arhantship. So if you still have some restlessness, there is hope. But we just have to see that it is a hindrance as well. It's a fetter. And so restlessness and worry is the mind can get caught in all sorts of proliferations in order to, just because it wants to chew on something, it can't abide just within itself. It isn't ready to be peaceful, and so it needs to proliferate about something, needs to be restless or worry about something. And it can really be anything, especially when we're meditating a lot, like on a retreat like this. It could be anything. It could be we could be thinking during the meditation, I didn't get the food that I wanted, I didn't get enough food, I didn't get enough sleep. We can really tie ourselves up in knots with these proliferations. And a lot of the time, the actual proliferation causes more bodily dukkha than what actually happened. So like, we can not get enough to eat, and then we might feel a little bit hungry, but then the restlessness might come up and we might pontificate around this for a while and work ourselves up and start fretting about it, and then that expends a lot of more energy, and so we use up more calories through that restlessness, and so we end up feeling even more hungry than we normally would, or we weren't able to get enough sleep, and so we start worrying a lot about that, and that burns up a lot of calories. Here's another interesting scientific fact that people who do work like that use their brain a lot, like computer programming, for example, burns three times more calories than like the average construction worker. So even though we're not doing physical work, then we're burning calories with restlessness and worry, and this is a danger. This is important. This is a hindrance, and then this might go hand in hand with sloth and torpor as well, because we burn more calories, we get tired, we get drowsy. So it could that they go back and forth. This type of agitation followed by drowsiness and lethargy. So antidote to this is just mindfulness of breathing, just coming back to the breath and breathing. And for myself, I like to focus on the cooling energy of the breath, or a cool aspect of the breath. So just cooling the mind down. Sometimes too, we have to see what we're actually proliferating about, and then use the Dhamma to ask ourselves, is that something worth proliferating about? Longpo has already brought up, we can't think ourselves out of thinking. We can't usually think ourselves to a solution. But sometimes we can actually ask ourselves, is this really worth thinking about right now? I think the whole issue of guilt also goes into this hindrance of restlessness and worry, because we can be mulling over things that we did in the past, precepts that we may have broken, or things that we did wrong, some way that we hurt somebody else. We can be mulling over that over and over and over again. And so this idea of forgiving ourselves, forgiving others, knowing that if it was something genuinely wrong and harmful, the best we can do is to make a determination to not do that again. And the past is gone. We don't need to proliferate about it too much. But because the mind is addicted to proliferating about it, then it's going to go in that direction. So we have to steer it in a different direction, steer it back towards the breath, steer it towards peace. Meiji Gao has this teaching that she said, so many people just tend to think and proliferate about their past and the difficulties and things they've done wrong in the past. And it's almost like a ritual. So you wake up in the morning and you grab a fan and you just fan the smoldering embers of your past, and you just keep those coals just going. And that's a good image. So she said, just let the coals just go cold. Let them die out. You don't have to fan the smoldering embers of your past sufferings, past difficulties. So we just take stock. Where are we at now? How can we move forward? Or we might worry about the future. So what's going to happen? This can happen in the monastery too. We might, meditating, might worry about the next step on the reception hall, or any little issue that might be happening in the monastery. The mind will just grab onto anything. Again, I have a lot of experience in this area because of just the mind always being interested in doing little projects and building things. So the mind will try to chew on that. And like these days I've been working on like sharpening all the tools in our workshop and kind of cleaning things up quite a bit. And getting into like using hand tools, like hand planes and things, and getting them really sharp, and finding some enjoyment in doing like some fine cabinetry projects. And so the first day of the retreat, I started thinking about that. But then this other voice was like, well, when you can't use your hands, then what do you do then? Is this worth thinking about? So just using these little questioning oneself type things. And Lungpo Cha would do that as well. He would say it was like the Dhamma coming in and teaching him, or just questioning him or cautioning him. So when the day comes when I can't use my hands, what'll I think about then? So it's not a seeing like these things aren't a refuge. Whatever we're proliferating about isn't a true refuge. And so what's really our refuge is the knowing. And so the knowing and coming back to the breath and bolstering up the sense of knowing. Then there's doubt. And so we can doubt ourselves. We can doubt the teachings. If we doubt the Buddha's teaching, we can ask ourselves, how many millions of people need to reach enlightenment before we'll stop doubting the teachings? So we can see so many examples, so many historical figures, recent history, past history, and the Buddha himself, just so many examples that the practice actually works. And so there's no need to doubt that. But usually what most people get caught in is doubting themselves. And so sometimes, no matter how many suttas we read, it won't fix that. It may even aggravate the situation. I think we feel we're unworthy or unable to follow the teachings. So we doubt ourselves. Again, I think it's always just like coming back to the knowing of these things. Knowing doubt is doubt. It's not going to be easy to convince ourselves to not doubt, or we might want to put it into it, not want it to be there. But somehow deep down inside, the heart is doubting. And so just knowing it, getting to know it, where is it felt in the body? I think doubt only really will start to subside when we just do the practice over and over and over again. And we run up against these things over and over and over again. We just meditate over and over again. Sitting meditation, walking meditation, seeing what works. We have the meal, so like meal contemplations in the monastery we do, like wisely reflecting, I use alms food not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, for keeping it healthy, helping with the holy life, thinking thus, I will allay hunger without overeating, so that I may continue to live blamelessly at ease. So we do that every single day. With anything, when we do it, if we stick at it, then and we really start to, and we really consider and think, what does that mean? What am I actually doing here? What are the mental factors in place? And we really investigate, then eventually we get things right. And that way we can stop doubting ourselves. Again, I could use an example in the workshop. I was about just persistence, the virtues of persistence. I was cutting a big piece of wood on the bandsaw, and the piece of wood was actually too big, and the bandsaw toppled over. This was like 3 weeks ago. The bandsaw toppled over, and the front of it got bent. And then when I picked it back up, the blade would not cut straight. It would start to go to one side, which is usually means it's maladjusted somehow. And so there's a whole series of tests you do. Usually that happens because the blade is dull. So took the blade off, sharpened it. That takes a long time. Put it back on, did the same thing. And then the other reasons that happens is things are not straight, things are out of true, so get the square out, look, see if the blade is square to the table and so on, it is, and get things just perfect, it still tracks. Oh, what's going on here? And there was a little bar on the front of the bandsaw that was bent slightly from when it fell. But I thought, oh, it couldn't be that. That has nothing to do with how the blade, which direction the blade goes, and but then think, okay, well, the wheels have to be perfectly straight with one another, and they were. So it's just it had been a couple days, and I was starting to get fed up and doubting whether this was actually going to be possible to keep the blade from actually going to one side while it cuts a piece of wood. And so I took a straight edge and just tested to see if the little table was true, and sure enough it had this thick steel table had gotten slightly bent. And I thought, well, how in the world am I going to straighten that out? And so I took this bar off the front that's bent, the table that's bent, and I managed to straighten the bar out, and I managed to put the table in a vise and kind of bang on it a little bit, and kind of got lucky, and it got perfect. And I thought, if this actually works, I'll never know why it worked, but I'll be happy that it works. But sure enough, I put it back together, and the thing just went straight and it was perfect. I don't know why that worked, but it was just like, you just have to try. Sometimes you just have to try everything. And Longpa was saying yesterday during the question and answer, responding to that question about Nibbana lies on the shores of death, and sometimes we just have to go to the edge. We just have to try. We just have to exhaust our options in order to stop doubting, and then it's just right there. We just have to clean everything out, and then it's just right there. But it takes a lot of persistence. And so that can be with practice or with anything in the world. We just takes incredible persistence. If we give up halfway, then we'll never come to an end of doubts. Again, that was the way that Ajahn Chah practiced. He has this inspiring saying that he tried so many different ways of practice, and he really put his life on the line. And the reason he did that is, if he didn't do that, he would always doubt. He would always be doubting. So to come to an end of doubt, really we just have to try everything in the practice. Try doing a lot of walking meditation. If sitting meditation isn't working, we can try doing a lot of walking meditation. If walking meditation isn't working, we can try doing more sitting meditation. If we're drowsy, we can try eating less. If we're restless, we can try various contemplations that the Buddha suggested for us. We can experiment. We can try less sleep, not talking. What's that like? Or things that just, how do I actually be mindful at all times? How do I have sati sampajanya, so mindfulness and clear awareness at all times? We just have to try various techniques. But we really have to engage with the practice in order to do that. And nothing comes quick, but it'll come according to our persistence. Even if we're not talented at something, if we persist at it, we can get good at it. So we don't have to be particularly talented at meditation in order to get good at it, but we just have to be persistent. Ajahn Kurnadamo brought this up in his talk, that there was a guest who was saying that even though we aren't meditating all the time in the monastery, it very much had that energy of being like a retreat or a retreat center or a place that was peaceful. And why is that? It's because everything in our lives, when we have the training, when people come together into a community for training, then everything in our life is pointing towards the meditation, is pointing towards being peaceful. And really that intention is held in the mind, and whether we're sitting, standing, walking, or lying down, whether we're going up to our cabins or even during the work periods, then things are... we're really working towards peace in every single way. So that's something good as well to contemplate during a monastic retreat, is that everything we do can be brought into the meditation. It's all connected. So these are just words, hopefully, that are encouraging and not discouraging for people. And I think that's enough for now.